Welcome to the Jump Ball Podcast. I'm your host, Mo Dockiel, and today our guest is Michael Pina from Vice Sports. This is his second visit. We talked all second round, Toronto Raptors, Cleveland Cavaliers, Boston, Washington, Spurs, Rockets, and we talked about the Warriors and whether they're going to be able to re-sign Andre Iguodala. So, you ready to tip it off? Mike, how you doing?
Good, Mo. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's playoff time, man, so never going to complain. That said,
Yeah. It's
got to be rough if you're a Toronto Raptors fan.
Yeah, but the thing is with the Raptors, like, if I was a Raptors fan, how optimistic could you possibly be heading into that series? Especially, like, after the first 10 minutes of Game 1, I would have been curtains from that point on.
Yeah, I'm kind of a big believer in your last game's important and how they nearly blew that Game 6 against Milwaukee after being up huge. Also kind of, like, catered into my head a little bit where I was kind of like, that's not a good way to want to go into a series. It's almost like they backed their way into winning that game and moving on. But it's interesting because, you know, when the trades were made and they got P.J. Tucker and Serge Ibaka and everybody was ready to start talking, this is going to be the team that's going to give Cleveland the most trouble. Yeah, not only did they beat him in four games, I mean, it really felt like just an ass-whooping in all four games.
Yeah, and I mean, I wrote a piece heading into the series on Serge Ibaka and just how, I mean, physically he looked just like a completely different player in that series against the Bucks. I mean, he was contesting shots by, you know, Thonmaker and Giannis at the rim and blocking shots, and he was wreaking havoc as a weak side guy. His rotations were nice. He had one of the best, you know, sport view rim protection numbers in the first round. He was everywhere. So I thought that he was going to be a difference maker in this series on the defensive end, especially when they went small and put him at the five. And, you know, he was just bullied by Kevin Love, and he couldn't handle Love, let alone switches onto LeBron or switches onto Kyrie or anything like that. So I thought that was pretty disappointing. And then you talked about Tucker, and, you know, his minute allotment was very interesting. I thought he would play a lot more. You kind of figure that that's why they got him, to match him up with LeBron, and they didn't really do that at all. Or not as much as you would expect, and he didn't start until, you know, the series was basically over in Game 4, so I thought that was pretty interesting as well.
Yeah, there was a lot of things that were really kind of interesting. One thing that bugs me about the Raptors in general, and it's been this way really since Dwayne Casey's been the coach, I just don't like that they don't really run anything. You know, it really is one of the ISO-centric teams that we have in the NBA. You know, it's DeRozan's going to basically ISO and get the mid-range jumper. We're going to get Kyle Lowry into a pick and roll, and he's going to create, but that's it. And obviously when you lose Kyle Lowry in the series like they did, you know, now it's just all on DeRozan, and there's no real, I didn't feel like there was a real offensive game plan in any sense of that. You know, when you're watching the Raptors, what are you seeing, and you know, is there stuff you kind of wish they did a little more?
Well, you know, I think Cleveland's defensive game plan made a lot of sense, especially after Lowry went down. They were just so aggressive on all the ball screens with DeRozan, and when he comes up, those pin downs they were trapping, and, you know, squeezing the ball out of his hands and forcing the other guys to hit shots. And it's very interesting to me. It's something I think I'm going to write about this week, is just Cleveland's defense and my takeaway from their performance in this series. You know, they allowed 111 points per 100 possessions against the Indiana Pacers in the first round, which is obviously terrible. And then they come out against the Raptors and they hold them, I believe, to under 100 points per 100 possessions, which is great. And I don't know if that's just, you know, the Raptors, their inability to hit these open shots. They shot, I think, below 30% from the corner, and a lot of those were wide open. And I don't think you can do that strategy moving forward, especially against, you know, whoever advances from the East. I think those teams have superior three-point shooting to that of the Raptors, especially the Boston Celtics. And then obviously, if/when the Cavaliers advance to the finals, you can't like the strategy would just get ripped to shreds by the Warriors.
Yeah, and it's interesting because do you feel like the Cavs have flipped the switch though?
You know, no. I think that for me, the term flip a switch was always about their defense. Because, you know, offensively, I never really worried about them. LeBron is just ridiculous. He doesn't really surprise. I don't think surprise is the right word to describe his performance to me. It's astounding and incredible. But you just kind of expect him to elevate his game when in the playoffs when things really start to matter. So he's just been out of this world, and you expect that from him. And then when they surround him with, you know, four shooters, those lineups are just absurd. But the defensive end and the thing I just talked about with how I think that they did a good job locking in and executing Ty Lue's scheme against the Raptors, but that scheme will not work moving forward. So I want to see, like, the personnel is still the personnel, and I don't think that this team has above average individual defenders still. They're still old guys for the most part. They'll be rested, but it'll be interesting to see what Ty Lue's scheme is moving forward, and I don't know if they'll be able to execute it as well as they did against the Raptors.
Yeah, it's true. I think, you know, every series does present itself like a different sort of set of problems, and it's kind of like you alluded to how they were able to take advantage of it with the Raptors and weren't against the Pacers and gave up so many points to them. It's just really interesting to see that. Where do you think the Raptors go from here now after losing the series? They didn't even challenge in. They made moves to be able to make a play, and now you have, obviously, Lowry's a free agent, and you know, he announced today he's opting out, and a lot of rumors of him heading west. You know, P.J. Tucker, Serge Ibaka, you know, they have DeRozan, who they signed to that huge contract last summer. Where do you think they go from here?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. I have no idea. like, if I was Masai Ujiri, I mean, so the options are obviously, you know, you can not re-sign Kyle Lowry. You cannot re-sign Serge Ibaka. You let Patrick Patterson walk. And in that situation where you're really starting over, I would imagine you send out feelers and you have to trade DeMar DeRozan. And so the total teardown is one option, but I kind of don't see them going in that direction. I think they'll hope and pray that Lowry accepts a contract, a four-year deal that is not the max and gives them a slight hometown discount, as I believe DeMar DeRozan did when he was a free agent. I really don't know about re-signing Serge Ibaka. I don't know how much money he'll command. If it's upwards of $20 million a year, I would stay far, far away from that. Because, I mean, this team and this core, I don't think that there's really a path to the championship. So if you want to stay pretty good for a while, and a year or two or three, maybe, depending on how long Lowry can stay in peak form, then that's cool. But you're not going to win a championship, so I don't really know what you're doing, and if you go that route. But then the other route, as I just said, you know, tearing everything down, starting over, that's not fun either, and that could last forever. So it's a really difficult position for them to be in, I think.
They're kind of in the quasi-Clipper situation, you know, with this many free agents, mm-hmm. and not sure what to do. And let's be honest, I don't think there's anything the Clippers are really going to do that's going to make them a contender in the West next year. And it's funny because you're same thing with the Raptors. Like, I don't feel like they can do anything one way or the other to speed up the process and really be able to contend. So it's definitely a tough job for Masai Ujiri right now to have to figure out what to do. And it'll be really interesting to see where Lowry ends up. Your gut feeling, just a guess, I know it's knee-jerk, no chance, no reaction to really look at anything or stuff like that, but is Lowry a Raptor next year?
No. That's my gut.
Do you know where you have a place in mind where you think he'll end up?
I have, you know, where I would like to see him end up is a team like, I want to see, you know, you talked about the rumors of him going west, and I think the team there is the San Antonio Spurs, and, you know, they're probably not going to be able to afford him if Pau Gasol opts in, as a lot of people expect him to. But I think that situation would be really interesting. And then, you know, he's from Philly. They want to play Ben Simmons at point, but it would be really cool if Kyle Lowry went down there, he ended his career or played the next 4 years as Philly's starting point guard. I think that would be pretty cool. I don't know how if he would be able to really accelerate their timeline single-handedly, but yeah, those are the two that just spring out off the top of my head. What are you thinking?
Yeah, one place that kind of keeps popping up where I'm like, this would be a pretty interesting spot is Denver. Combining him with Jokic and that whole group, I think would be pretty interesting. You know, Emmanuel Mudiay hasn't really produced for them. They have good guards and Gary Harris and stuff, but they don't have anybody that's really an elite level guy. And I think Lowry could kind of be there. But in my opinion, too, you never want to go west. There are so many point guards in the West. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I think Philly's an interesting spot. Although I don't want to have to hear all year long the Jay Wright rumors when he ends up at Philly. Because that's exactly what's going to happen. He's going to go to Philly, and if they struggle just even a little bit, everybody's going to start talking about how they need to bring in Jay Wright. And I just don't want to deal with this rumor. And, of course, I'm a Brett Brown fan, so obviously don't want to hear that at all. So I think that but Philly could be a really interesting spot as well. And he can kind of – if he's willing to deal with the fact that they might not contend right away, but maybe 2 years from now they might be in the mix. So that could be an interesting place as well.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, if – a lot will be, you know, the lottery will have a lot to say about this, but, you know, hypothetically, if they end up with the first and the fourth overall picks in this draft or something like that, that's a total game changer. And then if you sign Lowry, you have plenty of assets to, you know, really kick this thing into overdrive. And then you hope that Embiid would be healthy and Simmons or whoever else you hang on to, you know, because you could make a Godfather offer for Jimmy Butler. There's a lot of things that they could do then in that situation that I think would be really interesting. But that's really, you know, getting down the road here.
That's getting way down the road and putting a lot of faith in Colangelo. And I'm not sure I have that faith yet. He hasn't done anything yet that's really kind of blown me away. So let's talk about... obviously, you're a Boston fan. We got to talk a little bit about that series tied up. What adjustments did you see from Washington that kind of tied this series up after being down 2-0?
Yeah, I did a radio hit earlier today, and I was asked that question. And, you know, I don't really see too many I don't know about you, but I don't really see too many adjustments so much as, like, the Wizards are just healthy now in the starting lineup. And, you know, Markieff Morris, obviously, he injured his ankle in game one, didn't really play. He was, you know, maybe 75% or worse in game two. He was hobbling around. And, you know, that starting five just destroys the Celtics. And there's no answer so far that Brad Stevens has been able to find to slow them down. I think that Kelly Oubre's his suspension in game four. You know, Oubre's plus minus is atrocious, basically, because when he's in the game and Isaiah Thomas is in the game, you know, that really, his defensive responsibilities basically are reduced to nothing. He can stand in the corner. You know, sometimes they'll use Oubre to screen, but they can really hide him when he's in the game. So not having Oubre, I think, actually worked to Washington's benefit in game four. And then, you know, I think that defensively they were so aggressive in passing lanes, just jumping off the three-point shooters when Isaiah would run his high pick and rolls with Al Horford or with another screener. And, you know, they kickstarted that 26-0 run just by just smothering him and forcing all these turnovers, jumping in passing lanes. So if I were to look at any adjustments, I think just, you know, their health, Oubre's lack of presence and the impact that had in game four. And that's basically it. I mean, the Wizards could have easily won game two.
Yeah. I mean, they should have. Yes. Beal has a wide open shot that he doesn't miss, you know, 9 out of 10 times.
Right. And same, I thought Walsh shot was, I remember where I was sitting at that game, I thought Walsh shot was going to go in. We could kind of see where I, from my vantage point, that Beal was short the moment it came out of his hand. So everyone who I was sitting around, we exhaled. But no, they totally could have won that game, and it took Isaiah, I mean, 53 points in a playoff game is, that does not happen every year. So it took a magical performance out of him to go up 2-0. And this team is, I believe they're getting outscored on a points per possession basis in the series. So yeah, I don't know if there's any noticeable adjustments that Washington made to do what they're doing. I think that they just have such an advantage with the starting five.
Well, one thing I noticed that they did a really poor job in the games in Boston, and that they did a better job in games three and four, and you touched on it, where they were more willing to leave the shooters to clog up the lane on pick and rolls. You know, in the first two games, they weren't coming over far enough. You know, and I wrote about it on my site, and it's just, they were very inconsistent on where they needed to be help-wise. So, you know, you would see it in games three and four where they'd come over, you know, they'd come way over and cheat. And that's how Otto Porter got that steal off that pick and roll that led to a dunk during that run. And, and they just kind of clogged things up. Which leads to me, if I'm Boston, if I'm the almighty Brad Stevens, you know, I'm thinking, you know, I probably want to set the screen higher up. You know, and try to see if they're just going to trap IT. You know, let's really get them out of position and really stretch them, and try to find Horford on that short roll a little higher up. So, like, you know, when you're coming off that screen, instead of him rolling to the free throw line, he's rolling to the three, and that's a little bit more of a longer rotation for the defense. And then from there, Horford's got to quarterback it and find the right guys.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. And, you know, that was the big adjustment that the Celtics made in that first round series against the Bulls, where they would drag Robin Lopez out, you know, 25, 30 feet from the basket. And, you know, teams that want to put two on the ball with Isaiah, even if that is the mandate from the coach, like, executing traps on Isaiah is just, it's extremely difficult. So another thing is, you know, Stevens, who I don't think I've ever criticized him in my life.
Whoa! Are we about to get a breaking? Everybody needs to pay attention. Go ahead, please.
Well, I don't understand. Like, if I was coaching the Celtics, my number one thing would be to accentuate Isaiah Thomas's strengths, and that means getting him in those high screen and rolls with a big like Gortat and forcing Gortat to guard. To guard Al Horford. And so playing Amir Johnson, starting him in game four, I just don't understand. And then not only, I mean, he was a minus three in the first half. So Stevens started the third quarter with him, and, you know, he hit a corner three and I think he went to the line on the first possession of the third quarter. But like, besides that, he's just not good enough to start in a playoff series at this point in his career. And he really clogs things up. And, you know, Boston needs to go small, and they need to make the same adjustment that they did in the Bulls series, where they started Gerald Green. I do not think Gerald Green is the answer in this series. However, I think that, you know, dusting off Jaylen Brown, who I have no idea why he is not playing, or even starting Marcus Smart. I think those are the two guys that we should see in the starting lineup in Game 5. And I really don't understand starting Amir Johnson in Game 4.
Yeah, Steven seems to have a very quick hook with Jaylen Brown in particular. You know, and when he does get out there, it's as soon as there's a mistake or two, he's on his way back to the bench, and you're not going to see him for the rest of the game. So I'm with you. I don't understand the Amir Johnson starting. I don't see the advantage he's giving. He's not crashing the boards in a way where it's like, okay, we're getting a ton of rebounds out of it, even though he clogs the lanes. He's not even doing that, so I just don't see the point. So I'm with you on they need to get smaller and be able to spread that floor and make it more difficult and force Gortat into those pick and rolls. So that's going to be it's going to be a real interesting game five to watch, because it really does come down to, you know, who's going to execute their situations better. Can the Celtics get Isaiah Thomas off in the pick and rolls, or can Washington continue to really stymie, you know, and really frustrate him in that pick and roll and leaving shooters and stuff like that? I mean, Crowder hasn't really hit a three, it feels like, since game one, since he went nuts.
Yeah, he is a frustrating basketball player. the thing about him is, you know, theoretically, just like who he is a very helpful basketball player in 2017. You know, a 3-and-D swingman who can guard small forwards. He can be the big defending pick and rolls. But, you know, I think he's a little bit overrated in space as a defender at this point in his career, to be honest. And, you know, the numbers for his three-point shooting are great. But he's, you know, he's a streaky dude. And, you know, if he doesn't make the first two threes in a game, there's a good chance that he's not going to make the next five. And that's a really big problem, because this team, when you trap Isaiah and you successfully execute that scheme and you move the ball, you squeeze the ball out of his hands, like, you need these role players to come through. And Bradley did not hit shots in Game 4. Crowder did not hit shots. Marcus Smart, you know, I think he was started 2-for-4 and then he kind of trailed off. So these guys need to be the support system that Isaiah needs.
Yeah,
be successful.
Yeah, they got to be able to hit shots if they're going to play the pick and roll. If Washington's going to defend the pick and roll the way they're doing it, those guys have to be ready to knock down those shots. And I was just able to look up Crowder in the last three games shooting 20% from three, which is very different from when he went just completely apeshit in game one. But let's move on to this question, because we're watching these teams. And the one question I keep looking at or thinking in my head is, like, can either of these teams even take a game from the Cavs right now?
No, I don't think so, to be honest. I think after the first round, or maybe it was a little bit after that, I thought that the Cavaliers would enter the NBA Finals undefeated, and I'm standing by that. I think, you know, they'll have between 8 and 10 days of rest, I think, between their second round series and the Eastern Conference Finals. And you just look at, I mentioned earlier, you know, there are question marks about their defense, but even if the Celtics or the Wizards were able to exploit Cleveland on that end, like, nobody is guarding this offense. Like, and LeBron is playing ridiculous minutes. I just don't see how you slow their offense down, particularly at the beginning of those second quarters, you know, when he's surrounded by Channing Frye and just Kyle Korver, Deron Williams, just like not these guys who are really pinpoint accurate 3-point shooters. It's impossible to defend. So I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to slowing down Cleveland's offense. And then when they have anything going at all defensively, when they're locked in, I just think they're just a juggernaut right now.
Yeah, I just kind of look at it as Washington's not deep enough. If they play Washington, you know, once they go to their bench, it's all over. You know, Boston, I just have a hard time seeing them not being able to, you know, if they really want to, they can just put Braun on Isaiah, and then we'd really see some interesting stuff. But I don't think that IT would win that battle at all. And I think they're going to find ways to exploit IT defensively as well. So I just find it a very difficult thing. I'm kind of with you. I think maybe they lose a game by just because they're bored. But I do see them kind of running through the East, and that was kind of something I thought that might happen. You know, one place I do love to run through, though, is I always love running to Uli's Gelateria here in downtown. I don't know how often you listen to the podcast, Mike, but it is my favorite part. This is my favorite time when I get to give my favorite gelato ad. You know, and they're here in downtown LA in the Spring Arcade in between 5th and 6th Street with all the amazing flavors of olive oil, basil, sea salt, caramel, speculoos cookies, which is definitely my favorite. If you ever need to bribe me, that's what you do. Just tell me you're going to get me some speculoos cookies from Uli's Gelateria, and I'm pretty much game for about 85% of the things you're going to mention. So that's Uli's Gelateria in downtown LA in the Spring Arcade. It's on Spring Street in between 5th and 6th Street. And now back to hoops. And pretty interesting series we got going with Houston San Antonio right now. What are your thoughts so far there?
It's a fun one. you know, there's been a couple blowouts in this series where it looks like, you know, after game one, it looked like Houston was going to romp. And last night, obviously, Houston had their way. I'm still leaning. I heading into the series, actually, I picked the Rockets to win this in six. But, you know, where things stand now and with Nene's postseason-ending injury, which I think is a huge dagger. He's been playing extremely well as their backup five, anchoring those units when they put Ariza at the four and go really small. Last night we saw them have to play Ryan Anderson at the five, and you know, theoretically, I think that lineup can do a lot of damage, and it's incredibly difficult to defend, but it's really struggled in the defensive end last night, all those lineups with Anderson at the five. So I don't know. I think that the Spurs with two out of the next three at home, and then factoring into that with Nene's injury and a hope on my end that Greg Popovich spends more time small with, you know, Simmons, Kawhi at the four, Aldridge at the five, I'm leaning towards the Spurs right now.
Yeah, I had the Spurs winning this in seven. I'm still standing by it. I think this is going to go seven. I find this a really fascinating series because it's really putting Houston's philosophy to the test. Because the Spurs basically are saying, beat us with mid-range shots. You know, they didn't do a good job. If they're disciplined in their defense, which we saw in games two and three, they're basically saying, we're not going to help on drives. We're playing the pick and roll 2-on-2. Everybody else stay with your man. And every now and then you're going to get a guy that kind of gets sucked in because it's a reflex. It's not how pick and roll defense is taught all year. And this is kind of how Houston's able to take advantage of it in the regular season because it forces everybody to help. And that's where Harden finds these guys for three, you know, and makes plays and stuff like that. I think what it does, though, and what we saw, especially in Game 3, there were a lot of times where, gosh, I would just sit there, and if the Rockets would just pull up on a mid-range jumper every now and then, you know, they'd get a clean look. And I get it. I get the analytics. The mid-range jumper doesn't have value. To me, it has more value when they take away your other options, and that's what the defense gives you. You know, that's the one thing, coaching experience-wise and stuff, I've always said was, you know, take what the defense gives you. A friend of mine once told me a long time ago was don't fight force with force. So they're giving you this and you keep going to the rim and you keep getting blocks and you might get to the line and you might, you know, the Spurs are happy to give you twos and take away the threes for the Rockets. Like that's their game plan. So, you know, if they're not going to be able to get to the rim and always make a bucket, you know, they got to find other places to score. And I think their hatred for the mid-range game might actually come back to bite them in the ass in this series.
Mm-hmm.
But I find, I mean, the Nene injury is brutal, but it's also going to put them in an interesting situation of when they go basically five out, and it's going to put the Spurs in a tough spot because now when Ryan Anderson sets that screen, he's popping to the hoop, and now it's one-on-one, and gosh, I mean, it was definitely a challenge yesterday, but I don't see I didn't feel like Kawhi really had a ton of great energy into the game. There just wasn't a lot of stuff coming from the Spurs. They kept having a lot of breakdowns and weren't disciplined in their pick-and-roll defense. And, look, they got a great game from Eric Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
6-9 from 3, 8 from 13, you know, total shooting. You know, they really kind of had – they got the juices going. This is one of those games where they shot the crap out of the ball. You know, shooting 44% from 3, and it just kind of – it lit them up. And you kind of throw out the fourth quarter numbers because at that point the Spurs had sort of waved the white flags.
Yeah. I think Gordon had a hell of a game. I thought on the other end, I thought that Jonathan Simmons was, you know, playing his ass off. And I don't know how sustainable that will be, but I really liked Popovich's adjustment. I believe it was in game three when he finally – it might have been game two. I'm not 100% positive, but when he moved Danny Green onto Ryan Anderson, and I think it was game two, yeah, and he just completely took Anderson out of that ball game. And, you know, I don't think you can do that as consistently when Anderson's at the five. But, you know, I understand the need to play David Lee and play the David Lee, Aldridge, David Lee, Pau Gasol lineups. I just really wish that we saw. I liked seeing Anderson on the Spurs get a few minutes, even though he may not be ready for a series like this against this opponent. But I just like when the Spurs are as versatile as possible, even in lineups that don't have a traditional point guard. With, you know, they're in a tough spot now, obviously, with Tony Parker being out, and I think, you know, DeJounte Murray had some really nice corner crashes. Instead of, you know, settling for corner threes, he would attack and hit some nice teardrops from the baseline. But all that stuff is very, I don't know how sustainable that is. And, you know, they can throw out lineups that feature, you know, Simmons, Green, Ginobili, Kawhi, and Aldridge. Like, I want to see that lineup for 6-7 minutes and just see what happens.
Yeah, that would definitely be an interesting lineup. And Green's come on this series and really hitting shot. You know, he's making his threes. He's got a rhythm going. He didn't do too well yesterday, but in, you know, the past couple of games, and that's, again, allows him to spread the court more and, of course, keep him on the court because he's a pretty damn good defender himself. So it helps when they're able to put, you know, him on Harden for a while and rest Kawhi while he's on the court. You know, you hit it on the nail with Murray. Murray had a nice little stint, you know, started the game, I think, 3-for-3, finished 4-for-8, but he had a nice run. And I just don't know if Pop really is going to go small. He's never embraced it. You know, even last year when everybody was like, this might be the series to go small against OKC, and he just kind of stuck to his gun. So I'm not sure if he's really going to jump into that and embrace that small ball kind of attitude. But they have to get a little more from Aldridge. I mean, he's really been up and down, and his line's okay from game four, but, you know, only 16 points and 7-13 shooting. Like, when he gets the ball in the post, he's just taking too long and the double team's coming. Like, he needs to really be able to crush Ryan Anderson. Like, can Ryan Anderson guard him in the post?
You know, I actually interviewed Daryl Morey for a piece I wrote about Houston's defense heading into the postseason. And, you know, we talked a lot about Ryan Anderson is kind of this, you know, his reputation as a defender is obviously porous, but the Rockets really like his ability in those matchups when, you know, he's a little bit undersized against a post-up brute, and they like his core strength, they like his technique. I think, you know, putting him out in space is when he really gets exposed. But, you know, I think they don't really mind him in those physical situations on the block, particularly against, you know, I don't think any defense in the league right now is too worried about LaMarcus Aldridge one-on-one in the post, to be honest. And that's like a big problem for the Spurs.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, it definitely has felt like a very big drop-off year for him in the post, and it's just, his little fadeaway jumper doesn't seem to be hitting that much in the playoffs, so definitely a problem for the Spurs in that regard. I still think I'm always going to bet the Spurs. I still think they'll win this in seven. I think Pop will find a way to keep them going and disciplined. So you switched a little from the Rockets in six to the Spurs. You know, you touched on it. Was it really because of the Nene situation, or was there something else you saw?
Yeah, I think the Nene. I think just the. I didn't expect. You know, Danny Green's off the bounce verve has really impressed me. You know, we criticize him, or his reputation is as strictly a 3-and-D guy who can't really go. Once he gets run off the 3-point line, it's a disaster. I think his play in minutes where, you know, his role has been expanded because the Spurs really don't have anyone who can create consistent offense for themselves and for others besides Kawhi now that Tony Parker's out. So they need guys to step up, and, you know, there's been some signs from him and from some other guys that have really impressed me. But, yeah, at the end of the day, I'm looking at the variance that we're seeing from the 3-point line with Houston, and the, you know, I just was a huge fan of Nene and the role that he had for them, and the how much he factored into their success. So to be honest, like, his injury really makes me, like, yeah, that's the primary thing I'm looking at when I'm factoring in why I think the Spurs can win this thing. Just because, like, I don't know how good, like, I can't imagine if it goes to seven that Clint Capela has a dominant game. Like, I could totally see Clint Capela picking up two quick fouls. And then where do they go from there?
Right, right. Definitely. They're definitely that Montrezl Harrell spot.
Yeah, that's trouble.
Yeah, now you really have issues. Let's switch sides to let's go to the next series. Warriors going to close it out tonight?
Yeah, they are. Yeah. I would be very surprised if Utah won tonight's game.
Yeah, so I'm with you. I think the Warriors are just going to crush it. The, you know, both them and the Cavs Cavs went 8-0, and assuming the Warriors win tonight, them going 8-0. Like, it just kind of, I don't think that's ever happened in NBA history where both sides have swept through the playoffs.
Yeah, the only thing I could think of as a possibility would be before my time when it was Celtics-Lakers in the 80s. That's the only scenario I can really think of. Again, that was before I was born. So I'd have to
thanks, Mike. Mike. You're making me feel really, really old right now. Thank you.
Apologies. But yeah, so I'd have to go back and look. But that's the only thing that I can really think of off the top of my head. You know, in more recent times, you know, a few years ago, that mini rivalry between the Spurs and LeBron's Heat, you know, those two. When those teams were, it looked like those were kind of clearly the best teams in their respective conferences, and everyone anticipated a showdown in the finals. This reminds me a little bit of that, except I think these teams are better than those teams. So.
Yeah, I think so. At least offensively, both those teams are light years ahead, of course. Yeah, you know, so you wrote a really interesting article today. They came out today on Vice, or at least I saw it today. I'm assuming it came out today, but
you put in
the Warriors kind of in an interesting situation with Andre Iguodala's contract being up. And can you just kind of elaborate a little bit on it and tell the readers about it before you and I start debating it?
Yeah, sure. So Andre Iguodala is one of, and has been one of, Golden State's most important players throughout this entire run. You know, his willingness to come off the bench was humongous 3 years ago, or 2 years ago, I should say, when they won it all. You know, in game four of the 2015 finals, when a series that he ended up being the MVP of, Steve Kerr's decision to put him in the starting lineup kind of changed that whole series around, and it kind of altered how we view small ball and how successful small ball can be. So Iguodala is a free agent. He's 33, but he's a free agent this summer. And you know, there's a situation or a scenario, I should say, where Kevin Durant, who is also, who can also opt out of his contract and become a free agent this summer, you know, everyone expects Durant to re-sign with the Warriors, and, you know, he, there's almost 100% chance that he will, but there are several different avenues for him to do so, and, you know, one of them is for him to opt out of his current deal, which is $27.7 million player option, and re-signing for a $35.3 million deal, which is his max, and to do so would be, would mean that the Warriors had to use cap space to do to re-sign him, which means they have to renounce all their cap holds, which means Sean Livingston, Andre Iguodala, all the other free agents basically on the team would need to be also re-signed with cap space. And with Steph Curry also being a free agent, you can't renounce Steph Curry's cap hold because, you know, he's Steph Curry. So the amount of space that they would have to retain Iguodala drops to about $10 million or a little bit less or a little bit more than $10 million. And that's just not enough to hang on to him. So the other scenario, which, you know, I'm sure that the Warriors hope and pray happens, is, you know, Durant has non-bird rights on his deal. So he can sign a 1+1 starting at $31.8 million, which is 120% of his current contract. And with that deal, they would be able to stay above the cap and maintain all their current cap holds, and they would be able to keep Andre Iguodala and Sean Livingston and every other vital piece that they view on today's roster. So, you know, this basically is a connection between what Durant does and, you know, how that affects Iguodala's decision, because I would imagine he wants to get paid this summer, and there'd be a lot of teams out there who would love to have him.
Yeah, I mean, you summed it up great. I mean, that's exactly the situation. This is what good championship-caliber teams have to deal with now. You know, it's not just, we saw it with Miami, where trying to find the guys, the role players, to help carry you over to get to the next championship and to get the, make the next run with you is the hardest thing in the managing of the cap, and that's why you got to have an experienced GM and guys who kind of know what they're doing in the front office. So it's going to be a real interesting situation. I personally don't think Iguodala is going to leave. I think, you know, I think they'll find a way to keep Iguodala, but I think at that point they might lose guys like a Sean Livingston and pieces like that. And when you're in their situation, like, they got to hit the draft every year. You know, not necessarily a superstar, but a role player kind of piece when they're picking that late in the draft itself. And guys like Kevon Looney hasn't really produced anything. McAdoo's another guy who's really kind of a net zero for me. Doesn't really provide anything for them. So it's going to be really interesting to see what they do in the summer. I mean, despite however this finals turn out for them, you know, they're going to want to bring Iguodala back just for the same reasons you said. He is one of the most important guys on that team.
Yeah, and you look across, well, first of all, I don't believe that they have their first-round pick in this year's draft. I think that belongs to Utah. But, yeah, but I totally agree with you. They need to, when they do have picks, they need to hit on them because, you know, the margin for error here with regards to how much cap space the four stars take up. I mean, it's wonderful to have Kevin Durant and Klay Thompson and Steph Curry and Draymond Green all on your team, but those four guys, their contract is basically the entire salary cap. So you need to get very creative with how you fill around the edges. You know, they have, I believe it'll be the room mid-level exception, most likely, but that's only $4.3 million. And, you know, Iguodala's contract is going to be, you know, probably between 15 and 18, I would assume, million annually. So it's very tricky. I don't think anyone should feel sorry for the Warriors if they do lose Iguodala. This is just kind of, these are the breaks. This is the CBA kind of flexing its muscles and working, really, because it doesn't want teams like the Golden State Warriors to just run through the league every year.
No, absolutely. Where's your, if you were to leave, where would you want to see him? I'm guessing Boston.
But Boston was one team that I did write about. But, you know, to be honest, it's if I were him and money was the only thing that really mattered, like, it'll be interesting. I also mentioned the Lakers as a team that could be willing to pay him just because of, you know, if you just read the tea leaves here with, you know, the type of culture that they're trying to instill down in LA with Luke Walton, who was Iguodala's former coach with the Warriors, Rob Pelinka, who was his former agent, who is now the general manager in LA. I think that it wouldn't surprise me at all if they made a big offer to him and, you know, pitched him on being a part of something, helping turn this situation around similar in a way that, you know, when he joined the Warriors, they were already very good. And the Lakers are not very good and would not make the playoffs just because Iguodala signed with them. But it is the ground floor of what LA hopes to be a very successful rebuilding situation. So you could pitch him on that. Plus, you could say here is, you know, $20 million a year or whatever. And I think, you know, if they offered that much, it would probably be too much for them to afford a max free agent. You know, they can do things around the margins where they could deal a Jordan Clarkson or whatever down the road. But they need to, you know, if they are serious about going after Iguodala, they need to make sure they have enough space to sign Paul George in the summer of 2018. But, yeah, I mean, if I'm Iguodala and the Warriors win it all this year, like, he should just be looking to get the most money. Am I wrong to view it that way?
Yeah, I mean, I personally think he likes the feel I get from what I read and just seeing him interacting with the teams. I think he really likes being there. He's also really big in the kind of like as a tech investor, and I feel like Silicon Valley kind of definitely plays a role for him there. So I'm not sure how much of the money matters to him at that point. I really like the idea of him going to the Lakers, especially if they lose their draft pick. And they're going to have to start building a little bit through free agency a lot more than they would have if they have their draft pick. I think that kind of makes it an interesting situation where the Lakers could be an interesting spot for everything you said and kind of mentor the young guys. And then I'm sure they'll start to, you know, throw a few pieces to the Wolves to try to get a Paul George or another big name to start kind of building it up. And everybody's going to want to play with Iguodala. Like, he is one of the most liked guys in the NBA, if I'm correct. So, you know, I think it's a good piece for them. But I think ultimately in the end, I think he, as long as they don't like come in and lowball him, like, yo, veteran minimum, I don't see anything. And I don't see obviously seeing that happen. I feel like they're a pretty good organization over there. I think I kind of see him sort of staying with the Warriors, and they're coming to some sort of a deal that's fair, but it might even still be below market value. Like, I think he'll make more elsewhere if he really wanted to leave, and he'll have that opportunity, but I think he's going to want to stay.
Yeah, I think, you know, the big factor here is obviously Durant, and, you know, if Durant is willing to sacrifice about $4 million for the sake of the Warriors having the flexibility to retain guys like Iguodala and Livingston, then this conversation is over and the Warriors will be able to, I don't think money is really an issue, to be honest, in gold, or it shouldn't be, with regards to the luxury tax. So I would assume then that they would pay him right. They would do right by him and they would, you know, give him, I talked to someone in the league who was joking about how Iguodala better get paid more than Jamal Crawford this summer. And so if Kevin Durant were to re-sign and use his non-bird rights and allow them to stay above the cap and only, quote-unquote, get 31.8 million or 31 point whatever million next season, then, I mean, you got to pay the man, pay Iguodala like what he's worth. So, but then again, if Durant wants his full max and he is his right to seek that out and get that extra $4 million, then, you know, they just don't have the space to make a competitive offer at all. And I totally agree with you about there are more important factors sometimes than money, and Iguodala's happiness in the Bay Area. I mean, it's why would you want to leave when, you know, you could realistically, if they won this year, like, they would, you know, hands down favorite to repeat as champions, and this run could go on and on and on. But, you know, it would be tricky for him to take. It would amount to basically a pay cut. So it's a tough situation.
For sure. And we're going to get to watch it all play out in front of our eyes and comment on it. So, Michael, I appreciate your time, man. Plug what you're working on. I'm going to put a link to the article, the Andre Iguodala article, on the website. So anybody who finds the podcast from there can definitely click on it. So plug what you got coming out next, if you can talk about it.
Yeah, I'm just working on a couple things now this week that will hopefully be out by the end of the week. I don't want to get too deep into specifics in case they fall through and then I'd look silly. But yeah, just, I guess, follow me on Twitter would be wonderful, at Michael V. Pina. And that's about it. I'm just really enjoying these playoffs, even though, you know, on the surface they're not too dramatic, just because we kind of have a feeling of how things are going to end, at least up until the finals. But, you know, I personally just get I'm really enjoying the finer details of these series. So it's fun.
Perfect. Michael, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Mo.
That's it for this episode of the Jump Ball Podcast. Be sure to read Mike Pina's article on Vice Sports about Andre Iguodala's contract situation. And also be sure to like us, rate us, and leave reviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. Have yourselves a great day.